Hi there, and welcome to another episode of the Desi VC Podcast. I'm your host, Akash Bhatt, and I bring you leading investors and operators investing and building companies all around the world. Joining me on the show today is Priya Sai Prasad. She is the general partner at Turing Capital. She founded Turing after 13 years in venture capital, M&A, and enterprise technology. She was most recently a partner at SoftBank Vision Fund, where she led investments into category-defining software companies, including Pixis, Vendor, Observe AI, Commerce IQ, Sendoso, and Skidulo. Prior to that, she was at Mayfield Fund, focusing on early growth investments, and a founding member of M12, Microsoft's venture fund, where she led investments in GoOne, Workboard, PandaDoc, Element AI, and Bonsai. She was also the deal lead in Square's M&A team, leading acquisitions at the intersection of software and machine learning. She's been recognized by Forbes in 2018 as part of their 30 Under 30 in Venture Capital list. She holds a bachelor's in business administration from Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley. In this episode, I sit down with Priya and talk about some of the things that she's accomplished over the years being part of some fantastic household venture capital funds. We also get a little bit more personal and try and uncover the things she's learned from her childhood that's kind of helping her make decisions with respect to investments today, and the drive that she brings from within and some of her experiences that's kind of led her to where she is in her career. This is a fantastic episode for anybody trying to understand how to break in as a minority into venture capital and continue to build a very strong presence and brand. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Priya. Priya, welcome to the Desi VC Podcast. It's an absolute pleasure to host you here on the show today. I have been looking forward to this for quite some time. And all the reading that I've done up in the lead up to this episode has surely thrown some interesting content at me, and I can't wait to explore them with you over the course of the next 45-50 minutes. So on that note, welcome to the show, and how are you doing?
Thank you so much for having me on the show, Akash. It's wonderful to see what you've built with the podcast. I'm just really honored to be a part of it.
Very kind. But you know, I usually kickstart most of my episodes by asking people, especially VCs, if they kind of had an idea about how their career would pan out and eventually lead them down this path of becoming an investor. And more often than not, a lot of them are accidental VCs. Talk to me from that point of view. Did you know, was VC one of those things that was at least in your radar, or was it being talked about when you were graduating? And did you ever think about becoming a VC? And if not, when did that mind shift change happen for you?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I'd be completely lying if I said I always wanted to be a VC and that was my dream. I had no idea what venture capital was, to be honest, even in college. I didn't. And I went to Berkeley Haas undergrad, graduated in 2010. Mm-hmm. So around that time frame, venture was definitely popular. But when the Haas curriculum at the time was, in order to graduate with a business degree, you either do investment banking, you do consulting, or you do accounting, marketing. Yeah. Those were sort of the paths available. And so there wasn't as much of an entrepreneurial wave as there is right now at Cal. Right now, we've got so many amazing institutions. You've got the House Fund, Skydeck, got so much more of an entrepreneurial vibe, but that just wasn't there back then. Mm-hmm. It was very structured and there were a couple of paths to take. So I actually discovered venture in my first job at a college in investment banking. So mm-hmm. I started my career in investment banking. It was just one of the typical paths that you took with a business degree. And I actually didn't enjoy banking at all, if I'm being candid. I didn't love the particular part of banking that I focused on was leverage finance. So you were looking at much more mature companies, companies that would be acquired by private equity firms, et cetera. And I realized at that point that I actually want to look at the earlier part of a company's growth model. And I wanted to look at more vision that's being realized over time by entrepreneurs. And so I figured there has to be an earlier stage in this life cycle. So a lot of my peers at the time were post-banking, interviewing at distressed debt funds, hedge funds, private equity firms. But I sort of took the approach of looking into corporates, looking into startups, as well as VC firms. And so I accidentally sort of stumbled on venture.
That's a very interesting career path because as I was previously saying, not a lot of people who graduated in the 2000s or in the early 2010s really thought about venture as a career opportunity. It just happened so that the last 10 years or 15 years, the world has changed so much and tech has been the center of everything that we've done or are doing, that it almost becomes inevitable that you will have some sort of a crossover with venture in one way, shape, or form. Either you've heard about it, either you end up working with a company that has raised a lot of venture capital, or you're a founder trying to raise venture capital yourself. So in one way, shape, or form, you've been forced to learn about VC. And if you aren't doing any of that, it's been thrown in your face through the media. If you're consuming content in any shape or in any form online, or even through traditional, you know, newspapers. And that's been the fundamental change that's kind of come about, right? And while you went through something similar at your first job, you were exposed to it. What was your perception about venture when you saw it from the outside? And when you walked into your first job as a VC, how much of a reality check and how different was it when you had to do what you had to do?
It's a great question. So my outside in perspective of venture, and by the way, just as a little bit of background, I lived all over the world as a kid. And so I felt in some ways that I had to reinvent myself every time we moved to a different country. So I loved the entrepreneurial aspect of trying new things and sort of creating something out of nothing and pivoting, adapting, being resilient. So that had always resonated with me. So when I accidentally landed in venture, it sort of clicked in my head that, oh my gosh, this might actually be it for me. But from the outside in perspective, I have to say venture is just such a, it feels like this exclusive club and this exclusive society of folks who just happen to know each other for years and years. And it feels, to be honest, as an outsider, very intimidating to break in. You don't know how you're going to break into it. You don't know how you're going to really craft your own path. And I don't have family in the industry. I'm a true, true outsider to the industry. So for me, it felt a little bit intimidating, a little bit overwhelming. Would I be able to craft my own path in it? And then when I actually joined and started, so my first venture role was at Microsoft's venture fund. And I teamed up with Nagraj, who's now my partner at Turing Capital. So we've worked together for a long time. But when I joined, it was such a refreshing breath of fresh air, because the reality is, as a VC, I fundamentally believe any VC who says they know everything is just not the right type of VC, because VC is, you're learning from startups every single day, and your perception of what is reality and what the future holds is consistently evolving with market trends and is consistently evolving with every new entrepreneur that you meet. And the reality is, it's the entrepreneurs that are taking this massive risk. At least as VCs, we have a portfolio approach that we have, right? So you're able to have, you're never going to have, I mean, if you do, that's pretty incredible, but you're never going to have 100% of your portfolio be winners, right? You'll have usually two or three winners. You'll have, call it 5 to 6 medium exits type companies. And you'll have a couple that lose money or at the very least, you know, you've learned some lessons from, right? Mm-hmm. So your own portfolio will educate you about what you'll do differently in the future. So the thing that was so fascinating for me is it's a learning every single day on the job perspective. Yeah. No one knows everything. And it's a very humbling job, because the other thing is, you really don't know if you're good at the job or not until 5 to 10 years later, when it might even be too late.
I completely agree with that part, because I went through that the first couple of years of me trying to understand whether I'm good at my job or not. I constantly kept feeling that, hey, my investments weren't good. And that's just usually who I am and how I am. I write things off and hope that things in retrospect end up being good. So for the first 2 years, I found it incredibly difficult to do my job. And I didn't know whether I was speaking to the right set of founders, because every founder typically when they're fundraising is pretty good at selling their company and their vision. So am I really developing a thick skin for good sales pitches? And if so, how am I then trickling that down to understanding what's a good opportunity? Like, does that fit my fund's thesis? What kind of returns am I even providing? It didn't happen for the longest period of time until I had like a first exit. And I'm like, oh, okay, cool. This is basically what it feels like when a company gets acquired. And here's a little bit of that money coming back. So I'm not too shabby at what I do. It's a way of some validation that's coming in, but it takes a long time. And during that period, you have to navigate your own insecurities when it comes to, you know, work. And we don't talk about that enough, because obviously you go into work every single day knowing what you know and pretending to know some things when you don't, and just being confident, and at the same time, hopefully trying to learn things on the side and match whatever your little information that you have about something. And what happens, at least in my case with an agnostic fund, is that you come across opportunities from every sector that you cannot be, or you cannot come off at least as a learned person. You can't come off as somebody who knows everything about everything. You always know some things about most things. And I don't know if that's a good place to be in venture or not, because you don't really get a chance to like dive deep. You know a lot of surface level stuff and you can have enough conversation. But when it comes to investments, you have to go all in for the next 2 to 3 weeks and become an expert in 3 weeks. And it's very hard to become an expert in 3 weeks. So were there any insecurities like this when you were investing where perhaps you could share with us and normalize this job, which comes across to most people as a very fancy opportunity where you're constantly getting a chance to change somebody's life and only the success stories make it out? But what are the dark things about being in VC? What doesn't meet anybody's attention on the outside?
Yeah, no, it's such a good question. I think the darkest part about venture for me is that you just don't know. There's no certainty in front of you. If you're someone that's used to, you like answers, true yes and no, you think of things in black and white, right? Venture is a very hard place to survive, because even as you develop conviction about a deal and you're leaning in, you want to do the deal, there are so many doubts that go through your mind. You're like, I think this is great, but here are all the risks associated with this, and here are all the ways this company could potentially fail.
Yeah.
So am I convicted enough where I'm 60% leaning towards doing the deal versus 40% leaning towards, right? Mm-hmm. And how much farther from 50% am I leaning towards a yes or a no? And then you start to, as an analytical person, you start to overthink everything. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, this fails. What happens? What happens with this category? Oh my gosh. And then, you know, at a certain point, I had a lot of fears, especially my first couple of deals. Because your first couple of deals in venture in a certain way sort of define you, right? Yeah. They follow you everywhere. Your track record is everything. Mm-hmm. And if they don't end up being, let's say you do your first three deals, which I think are the most important three in venture, and all three aren't great for one reason or another, that doesn't necessarily mean you're a bad VC. It mm-hmm. just means you're learning from those deals, and then you're ideally going to apply a different sort of lens in how you view deals in the future, right? In fact, your fourth, fifth, sixth deal might be infinitely better because you've had the best learnings. But unfortunately, it's also a very, very, it's an industry where you're judged externally based on the deals you do. So there's not a lot of wiggle room or leeway to necessarily work yourself out if your first three deals happen to not be the best, right? So you really, so your first three deals, I was really overthinking every single thing. And I was really thinking about it very hard. One anecdote that I do want to share is I tend to be a very, very analytical person in how I approach most decisions. I have like detailed Excel models on just basic decisions. But I was talking to Nagraj, who's been my mentor for a long time and is now my partner at Turing. And he said to me, the worst thing that can happen for you in a deal that you do is you lose 1x, right? Mm. You lose 1x the money you put in. The best thing that could happen to you in that deal is you return the fund.
Yeah.
Right. So to relatively look at it that way, if you are leaning 60, 70% towards a high conviction deal, your downside is not as bad as your upside could be. So once I sort of reframed that in my mind, it was a little bit more helpful for me to overcome some of these insecurities as I was looking at deals and really lean in to my gut in addition to what the data was telling me.
It's a very interesting point that you made there, where you talked about the risk that's involved in an investment, but also at the same time, when you were saying the three investments that you made and you don't know whether they were going to be a hit for the fund or not,
yeah,
a lot of the variables that are involved in any investment being a success are also not in your hands. They're in the hands of the founders in most cases. And in some cases, a lot of that success also is not in the hands of the founders. A lot really comes down to where the market is, what happens around you, the kind of people that you end up hiring, what your competitors are doing in the market, and how quickly are you able to like get feedback and learn from that feedback. So in order for you to be a good investor, you're trying to understand, can I be a good people evaluator?
Yeah.
And half the job is just understanding and knowing whether this person can be somebody who can, one, have leadership, two, navigate tough waters, and three, just be able to attract good talent. Because one of the hardest things that any founder will tell you is that, hey, fundraising is hard, but hiring is even harder, at least in the early days. Sure, there are a few brand names that can probably attract talent, like you got money from a Sequoia and Andreessen or a SoftBank. You know, it'll be easy for somebody to say, okay, cool, I'm working for a startup that's backed by so and so. But if you don't do so, sometimes it becomes harder to just pull people into your company. And the variables that are involved in somebody being successful, be it a founder, be it a VC, is so uncertain that you don't really know what sometimes works and sometimes doesn't. You know, you talked about three data points for you to even make sense of anything. No matter how analytical you can be, three data points are not enough for anything. Any good coach will tell you that. Like if you go to a basketball player and you tell them like three instances of you shooting, they'll be like, coach, shoot 10,000 times and come back and I can probably make a little bit of sense of it. But you don't have that luxury in venture capital, unfortunately. So over the years, while you've made investments, you've probably not had the luxury of making hundreds of mistakes. You probably had the luxury of making 3 to 4 mistakes and then quickly learning from them. Yes. What are some of the things that you've learned when investments, in your opinion, haven't gone according to plan?
Ooh, it's a great question. So I'm going to pivot a little bit. I was part of Mayfield Fund. Mm-hmm. And at Mayfield, one of the biggest philosophies that Naveen and team have over there, which really resonates with me till today, is we are people first and people make or break companies, right? So it's exactly what you mentioned. It's the founder and the people that the founder is able to attract. But what do you look for? What are the qualities? What are the characteristics that you end up looking for? And the reason is because markets come and go. Why now is really, really hard to predict in a lot of ways. You can have a lot of customer data points. You can talk to buyers, et cetera, and you can get a little pulse for what's happening if this can be a category. But then let's say the economy tanks or something else happens. Those are such external factors that are a little bit out of control. Or let's say the budget and the buying center completely shifted and there's no PMF anymore that resides for this particular company. Is the entrepreneur resilient and strong enough to be able to pivot and navigate through turbulent waters? Because there's almost no startup, even the most successful startups over time, have not had a linear line upwards. It's always been this sort of zigzag line upwards, right? Where you'll have some amazing days, you'll have some terrible days, et cetera. But can the entrepreneur sort of pivot? Can they work their way through that? Are they also a consistent learner in that mindset? And do they surround themselves by experts and advisors who can help them navigate through turbulent waters, especially if you're a first-time founder and you've never done it before? It's terrifying in a lot of ways, right? It's an emotional roller coaster. So I'd say definitely people is what I've realized makes or break companies in the long term. So anytime an investment has gone somewhat south, it's actually been a little bit more of the team oriented versus something completely external.
Mm-hmm.
So from those failed attempts, if you were to call them, I actually don't like calling them failed attempts. I like calling them massive learnings, because it's learnings for us as VCs, but it's also learnings for the team, the management team over there, who've gone on to actually do incredible startups in their second or third try at it, right?
Yeah.
So it's a wonderful learning trajectory. The other thing is, while it's impossible for any one VC to necessarily have 100 shots at the goal, right? That would take an entire person's 50-year career, if you will. But the good news is, when you're surrounded by mentors at a VC firm who's done this for years and years in the past, you can sort of learn from their track record and seeing where they've gone wrong in the past, where they've gone right. The VC is such an apprenticeship business, which I do really enjoy. But it's apprenticeship business that you have to craft for yourself, right? Because with most jobs out there, non-venture jobs in corporates, et cetera, you have a job description. You have quarterly OKRs that you have to hit. You sit down for performance evaluations, et cetera. That concept doesn't really exist in venture.
Yeah.
You have to sort of seek out the mentors, even within your own firm for the most parts. Mm-hmm. And really, you have to be in the driver's seat getting the mentorship that you need, mm-hmm. or else it doesn't really happen. There's no job description. There's no necessarily quarterly OKRs and updates that you can really hit, especially because you don't know how your deals are doing for years. What's in the OKRs, right?
Yeah. No, that's a very interesting point that you bring up, because when we had OKRs for the first time, it would be mostly around the number of companies that you spoke with. And did they meet the certain criteria that the fund had? Like, hey, we wanted to invest in X number of immigrant founders on a yearly basis. And therefore, you had to meet with X number of immigrant founders. Did you meet those OKRs? But nothing that could really translate to anything on the ROI with respect to the fund or the investment. Like, it's those numbers were constantly like TBDs. You wouldn't know them for the longest period of time. And whatever you knew was yearly audits and things that you could possibly, like, again, these are numbers that can change today, and in a year's time, it can look completely different.
Right.
So you don't really have like a true indicator towards anything that kind of tells you if you're doing something good at your job or not.
It's very true. Yeah. That's why the uncertainty, there's never going to be certainty in venture. You almost have to be used to that nebulous territory.
Yeah. I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. What do you think?
It's a bad thing for a type A planner.
Yeah.
I'm a type A planner, but it's been so great over time, because this has translated into my personal life as well. Cause I've always, up until college, I've been a crazy planner. I planned out, mapped out exactly what I was going to do, et cetera. Mm-hmm. My career did not go in the way that I thought it would in any way, shape, or form. I could never have planned the things that have happened specifically in the career.
Yeah.
And so being able to, in some ways, being able to let go and help life guide you in some ways, and help the people around you inspire you and guide your direction, I think that spontaneity has been a great journey for me that's translated into my personal life as well.
I love that. And there's very few times that your personal life and your professional life can actually benefit off of one another. And I think venture is just one of those things that's uniquely positioned in that way, because with a lot that happens in somebody's personal life, you don't really know whether you made the right decision up until a few years down the line, right? I mean, it could be a partner that you're seeing. It could be, you know, anything else on the front of, let's say, you're investing in something that is a little bit more personal to you. It could be, you know, deciding to like move to a new place. You've done that quite a bit in your early part of your career. You don't really know whether this is a good decision or not up until a few years. Like, you cannot fall in love with the place the first time that you move. It's going to take a while up until you get familiar with things that you like and things that you may eventually end up liking, which happened to me with San Francisco, moving from New York to SF. It was one of those decisions that took 2 to 3 years for me to like get to even one, accept, and two, then start liking. So it took a while before I started liking San Francisco and everything that came with it. For the first 2 years, it was, oh, I hated it. And then quite similar, it's like, you know, investing in a partner and that journey, you got to know that you got to keep putting something into it and hope that it pays off in time. And pretty much the same with founders and VCs, the relationship as well. You hope that every founder that you bet on is probably going to give you a return, and therefore you're going to continue to help that founder as much as possible. They're constantly going to be at the back of your head, especially if you're on a board and you've been on boards of companies. You know that there's more accountability on both sides. It's almost like a check-in, just saying, hey, this is where we are. This is what we're doing. This is where we think we may need a little bit of your help. And at that point, it gives you an opportunity to also brush up on things that you may or may not be skilled at yourself. Because yes. At some point of times, a founder may come to you and say, hey, we're looking to hire a senior executive. Can you help me with hiring? You may never have done hiring before in your life, and you now have to learn how to hire, learn how to like interview somebody at that level, and then try and understand, am I gauging the right things during an interview or not? So you're learning constantly previously, as you mentioned. So these are new things that happen and quite similar, very few things that kind of like translate your personal life and professional life.
It's so true. You said something that really sparked something in me. I think the fear of failure that we have just inherently as humans, I think, but also in the educational system, you can control things a lot more. You can control how much you study, gives you your output, et cetera, right? But that fear of failure is something that prevents you from actually seeing a ton of success. Through life in general. And I think venture is just one of those rare spaces where you can't be afraid of failure because you know going into it, you're going to fail.
Yeah.
There's no way that
the
anyone-
The odds are stacked against you.
The odds are stacked against you, right? There's no way if you make 10 investments, all 10 are going to be the best investments in the world, right?
Yeah.
So you are going to fail, but you are going to learn from that failure. And the one trait I find that differentiates, in my opinion, a good VC versus an okay VC is just that consistent ability to learn, pivot, tinker, and consistently, if you, for instance, as you mentioned, if you find a new sector that you haven't spent time on before, you have 3 weeks to get educated on it, right?
Yeah.
But being able to do that really fast, being able to leverage your network and other folks who are truly experts in it to help inform you, I think differentiates sort of someone who's really scrappy versus not in this space.
I agree. And one of the other things that you mentioned was just accepting that failure is an inevitability in some way, shape, or form in venture. Being South Asian, we also have a very different relationship with failure, wherein failure for us is not this, failure is not a stepping stone. Failure is a disgrace. You kind of almost bring shame upon your parents, your family in some sense. So you kind of grow up having a fear of failure. And that's not a nice place to start, especially if you're in entrepreneurship or if you're a VC. And then breaking out of that cycle is a very difficult journey for a lot of South Asians or even Asians in general, where culturally we are there's a lot of stigma against failure. Have you had to like face anything like that during your investment days where you probably draw a lot of those roots back to your childhood? And I can give you an example, perhaps on my side to nudge you in a direction where I'm hoping this question leads to. I grew up with all my investments, I looked at them with a lens of skepticism of, oh, hey, this is not going to work out. And if this is not going to work out, then what is going to be my my backup plan? Can I, with every investment, is my chance of failure coming 1% down? And if not, then I may not want to like invest in this company. If it still remains the same, if I still fear, okay, this is not as good, is it going to work or not? I don't know if that's the right strategy to take into venture, but that's one of the things that I subconsciously was doing, is trying to figure out whether tomorrow's founder is better than the one that I met the previous day, and so on and so forth. And if not, then I would either do one of two things. I would tell myself that, hey, you're not meeting better caliber of founders, so you're not doing a good job. Or if I was meeting the same type of founders who weren't like adding anything different, then that meant I'm not going to be investing in any of these, irrespective of what. So you need to have your own personal thesis in some sense, especially when it comes to founders. And that was my thesis. If I wasn't meeting better founders every single day, then I'm not a good, that was one way of me evaluating whether I was good at my job or not. And that came down a lot from my childhood, where I was exposed to this concept of, your friends need to be better than you, and you need to be hanging out in better circles. And if you're not, that either means you're stagnant or none of you are growing. And that kind of like made me want to like seek out circles where I was probably the least smart person. And that kind of has helped me in life. Of course, I've got constants in life, but there have also been opportunities where I've been seeking people who are way smarter than I am. It's a different thing that an imposter syndrome can kick in at some point of time, but that's a different, we won't touch that for now. But that's one of the things that translated from my childhood to perhaps my time in investing. So I'm curious to see if there was something from your childhood that you perhaps brought into your time in investing.
Yeah, it's a great question. So a part of this, I'll take it back to my parents and sort of how they raised me. So I will say my dad is one of the main reasons why I am where I am today. He's helped me a lot with drive, ambition, motivation, et cetera. But having said that, he was a type of person where, you know, I would come back from school with a particular grade in a class, and I might have gotten a 95 on the test, which is an A, right? But his question was not, why didn't you get 100% versus a 95, which would actually be like a normal, I don't know, fine question, just a typical Indian dad question, right? But instead, his question was always, who got higher than a 95 in your class?
Yeah.
And I would say the names of the folks, he'd be like, wow, they're very impressive people. So it was just this very comparative sort of mindset that I grew up with. And it made me an incredibly competitive person, which was fine in college, et cetera. But in the world of venture, the first time it actually hit me that this is something that I need to take a step back and really evaluate, it made me a very competitive person, but also someone who really associates a lot of my value with external validation versus necessarily sort of internal validation, which I've had to unlearn a little bit over time. But when I did my first investment, it's not the first investment I ever did, but the first investment that wasn't an awesome investment that I had done. When I did that and I started seeing things go south, and I instantly started getting into this spinning mindset of, oh my God, what are people going to think of me? And what is my perception going to be out there? I'm going to be viewed as some sort of a failure. And oh my God, I need to resolve this, and I need to problem solve here. But the amount of sort of external pressure that was on me was actually, it was a very dark time, really. And from that perspective, where if I didn't have that sort of external pressure that I had, and I was just thinking first principles and how to problem solve, how to help the entrepreneur over here. And, you know, there will be ups and downs, and how do we get this to a decent outcome for all parties over here? If I had thought about it from that perspective, it would have, I feel like I would have handled it a lot better, but I was operating from a place of panic. And over time, I ended up having to actually give that up because it was actually really unhealthy, and it made me doubt everything in future investments. And so I had to really unlearn that. And the reality is, there are so many moments in a startup's life where it's ups and downs, and you don't actually know if it's successful or not until an exit happens.
Yeah.
Right. And your job as a VC is to help the entrepreneur, help the management team, such that they can navigate through these down times and to position them for an exit. The ironic part is the company ended up exiting for a decent multiple, actually. So it was the founder was really happy in the end. We as VCs were pretty happy. But at that moment, which was 2 years before their exit, it was kind of nerve-wracking. And yeah. Now looking back on it, I wish I could have realized this is going to be a startup's journey, and it's not a testament on me. It's not a testament on the founder. That is almost embracing failure in its face without being nervous about sort of external perception. Oh my goodness, what is my reputation, et cetera. Those are all such intangibles and also inconsequential in the grand scheme of building something massive.
Right. And you also talked about being part of competitive environments, or fortunately or unfortunately, kind of maybe competitive, being in a house where you are constantly asked and compared to people who are doing better than you. Do you think that competitive spirit and attitude kind of like helped propel a lot of your decision-making process in the later years in your professional career? And I also say that because you were part of the SoftBank team where obviously, it's one of the most coveted jobs that most VCs would want. And at the same time, it's not easy to get it. And two, when you make it, you're literally brushing shoulders with the best of the best investors in some sense. Okay. Just not talking about the best people in the world, but best investors. There's a difference between both those statements, because you could be a very, very smart person with a very bad acumen for investing. But once you make it and you're a good investor, it's a different ballgame altogether. You don't need to be the smartest. You just need to know how to pick up on certain signals within the world of VC. So it's a different competitive spirit all throughout your career that you've kind of like carried forth. And how did it change when you were at SoftBank? Was it, did it drive you? Did you feel something different? Or was it a different level of competitiveness that kind of like came in?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I'd say the competitive dynamics in venture is it's very prevalent. You're competing against another VC firm across the board. If there's a good company that you're extending a term sheet to, there's likely other VCs involved. Yeah. Then you're competing against you having the board seat versus this one specific person at another firm having the board seat. So then there's that personal level of competition as well. Then there's competition for, is it this startup versus another startup? There's that competitive element as well. Then depending on which firm you're part of, and I've had the privilege of being part of three very different, but very, very, very good firms.
Yeah,
very unique firms, right? And sometimes you're competing internally as well. Right. So there's
You can only make X number of investments.
Exactly. There's only a certain finite number of investments that get done. And you have really high conviction on this particular deal. And depending on partnership dynamics and how it works, there's competition from that element as well. So in a sense, being a highly competitive person and growing up with competition as a core tenet of my personality, I had to actually let go a little bit, to be honest. I had to let go of, you can't control this many competitive variables. It's too much. So the reality just becomes, first of all, what is most important and prioritizing radically at the time. So if I'm trying to win a deal, I'm competing against a particular firm. That's the number one thing that I can think of. I can't control anything else in my mindset. The other thing that I realized over time is, you know, an entrepreneur VC fit is so unique because it's a relationship that lasts for sometimes a decade, sometimes even more than a decade, right? And so, yes, I can convince the entrepreneur that I'm better than this VC, or please accept my firm's money versus that firm's money. But the reality is, does the entrepreneur want me? You want them to want you equally, just as much as you want the entrepreneur, right? And you want this to be a very healthy partnership over time. And so I've had to actually let go a little bit in my strategy over time, where I will talk to you about all the great things about our firm, about the value that I personally can add on the board and the network that we bring, et cetera. But it's not about us. There's some deals where, honestly, another firm is actually a better fit than we are. Mm-hmm. And we will partner with that firm. It's actually a long game where I've ended up co-investing and partnering with a lot of my competition over time. So it's one of those things where if you don't win this one, that's fine. There'll be the next one. And hey, you might even co-invest with this other VC in the future. It's actually less of a competitive dynamic than I would say flipping the switch on the competition and saying it's actually very collaborative of an ecosystem. This entrepreneur who may have rejected your term sheet before might be starting another startup in the future and might actually think of your term sheet. I've had that situation happen in the past as well. Yeah. And so it's a very incestuous ecosystem, and it's so relationship driven that competition can't actually be your core value and tenet. It has to be actually collaboration and relationships and that sort of long-term partnership mentality.
Yeah, it's not a zero-sum game.
Yeah.
It's not absolutes. Like somebody doesn't have to lose for you to win.
Yes.
And you can always collaborate with your competitors. You can work with them, because at the end of the day, you're all hoping for one thing, is the company turning out to be a success. Now, the kind of role that you end up playing in that journey is obviously going to matter, and it's going to be different. And you might get competitive on the ownership percentages at max. Right. And in some cases, as you mentioned, if you don't get ownership or you don't get an investment right now, there's always going to be an opportunity if you maintain a good relationship with the next round or the one after, or a different company that a founder ends up founding at a later stage in their careers. It's a relationship-centric industry where you're competing, but you also want to have good relationship with your competitors. Yes. And at the same time, you know that a fund like yours, at least the previous two funds, were almost stage agnostic. So mm-hmm. you knew that if you lost out on a deal today, you'll always have an opportunity 12 months down the line or 24 months down the line and so on and so forth. So it's really important for you to have your enemies close in some sense.
Yeah.
And in, you know, they always say have your enemies close. But I think in venture, it's even, it takes a different meaning altogether, because you have to have a lot of people close to you because of the relation, how closely driven it is. And it might seem like such a big industry, but it is really, really small.
Yeah.
What gets around.
And your reputation really is everything,
everything
in this industry, right?
Yeah.
Especially as you continue rising within your career over time.
I mean,
people just know you across the board. They've either been on a board with you, or they've seen you speak at something, or they've spoken at something. It's such a small world.
It is.
And so it is so important to view folks as friends. Versus, I guess frenemy is the word.
Yeah, frenemy indeed. And it's one of those things that every time you put yourself out there, you have to be so mindful about what is somebody going to think about me and how am I going to get perceived? And that was one of those insecurities I had when I was doing the podcast is, hey, this is going to live forever in some sense. It's on the internet. Somebody can go back and hear how I sounded in 2020 and judge me for what I sounded in 2020 and 2028. Like, is that something I'm going to be comfortable with? I'm like, yes, yeah. Because me in 2020 is so different from me today and so on and so forth. I'm going to learn. You're going to learn. I'm sure the first investment that you made, as opposed to the newest investment that you made or will make, you are a completely different person. And the way that you looked at an investment is completely different. And the learnings that you've had since have been abundant. And today and the only way that for you to have become a better investor today is because of that opportunity that you had. And if you hadn't had that opportunity, you probably wouldn't be a better investor today. So you've got to make your mistakes. You've got to have that opportunity to go through that journey, because nobody starts off hitting a home run from day one.
Right, right. No, it completely makes sense. And actually, you made me think of something interesting where, you know, this is probably my Indian family growing up. One of the things that was really instilled in me and my sister was prestige and sort of being able to be seen as someone who's super hardworking and someone who's at a good place in life.
Yeah.
And prestige takes different forms, but I guess in venture, working at these large firms like SoftBank, Mayfield, M12, et cetera, there's a certain, I guess, quote unquote, prestige associated with being affiliated with those firms. But I feel like I've finally broken free from some of these shackles of my childhood mindset of thinking about things, because deciding to start Turing Capital and leaving the confines of larger funds that are very reputable, et cetera, and just crafting my own sort of entrepreneurial path over time and rethinking what I want out of venture and what I want out of this fund was kind of a culmination of being an entrepreneur myself and some of the learnings I've had over the last decade.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. Why Turing Capital? Why now at this point in your career did you choose to break out and start something new of your own? And second question as a lead up to that is, you said what you want from this fund is very different from what you'd probably wanted at different jobs that you've held, especially as a VC.
Yeah.
What is it that you're hoping to achieve with Turing? What is the larger vision here? And I'm not just talking about, I want to like bring entrepreneurs in, change the world. Of course, we all want to do that. But why is this such a personal journey for you that you decided that now was the right time for you to do it?
Yeah, it's a great question. So looking back at my career in venture, the North Star that I realized that I've always had is making a difference in an entrepreneur's life and truly getting to partner with them. Most of the pleasure I get from the job that I've realized over time is that call on a Saturday morning with an entrepreneur, really being sort of almost a therapist for each other in some way, shape, or form. That's been my North North Star the entire time. And I love the founders I've backed, regardless of the exit outcomes they've generated us over time. It's been wonderful, that partnership, that journey. And I wanted to sort of recreate or rethink what a venture firm that is so founder driven and so founder focused at the Series B and at the Series C stage, which is where I've had a lot more success in my exits and track record over time. But I wanted to recreate that, because sometimes at the growth stage, if you will, or even early growth stage, we're not growth, but we're, I would say, early growth. At that stage, it tends to be a very transactional relationship, and it can be very transactional because you already have your early stage VCs on the cap table who've really helped you across the way. And you now have numbers, metrics, et cetera, that are fairly easy for an outside NVC to come and evaluate. But to bring that sort of relationship-oriented mindset into that early growth stage of investing, where you're good at the analytics, but it really is still about the entrepreneur and it still is about their vision and their mission, et cetera, is something that I haven't seen a lot in the industry. And I wanted to do that in particular. And why now? And why start a VC firm now? If you think back towards the prior downturns that we've had, some of the best venture firms were created and venture vintages were created during times of scarcity. And so I knew that this year and next year is exactly that, right? So if we're able to make it, launch a net new venture firm, and we're able to make it in this scarcity mindset, then I think we can build something that's truly lasting. I want this to be a 100-year plus firm that we build. So I've always been sort of very long-term in thinking about what Turing can do 10, 20, 30, 50 years from now.
That's a very interesting mission that you have. And I also like how it's very close to what you want to do and what you've kind of like learned. In some way, it's a culmination of the things that you've done, are doing, want to do, with the larger context of what does venture mean in general to a lot of VCs when they set out investing, right? Yes. So you've taken bits and pieces of all of the experiences that you've had in some sense and kind of like put your personal touch into it as well. And, you know, we're almost at the end of the hour here, but I have one more question that I typically end up asking most people who come here on the show is, reflecting back on the journey that you've had, you know, if you were to restart this journey all over again, in some sense, you are restarting, you know, your career in VC, because it's a different ball game. Your own fund and having your own capital and investing and being responsible and accountable. Not that you weren't, but you're 100% accountable at this point of time as before. What kind of advice would you like to give yourself? Or what are some things that were just top of mind for you when you were deciding to start Turing Capital? What were some of those basic things that you kind of like wanted yourself to hold yourself accountable to as you were starting this? Not just your LPs and other stakeholders, but what is it that you were really trying to change in some sense within the world of venture? And how are you trying to stick by those?
Oh, that's a very interesting question. So let me repeat. So the question is mainly, what different thing am I trying to do with Turing Capital than any platform before, right?
Yeah. What different? Yeah. What is something different that you're doing? And two, what with this new venture that you're getting out to the market with, how are you different as an individual as opposed to how you were before? Like, what is it that you have learned that you're, which is perhaps top of mind for you today as you're going in investing?
It's a great point. If I were talking to my college self now, the biggest learning I would say is how important the people that you associate yourself with, your partners that you're working with every single day, is, and the culture that's being fostered, the culture of openness, transparency, the culture of you feeling like you could bring 100% of yourself to work every single day, where you can be your authentic version of yourself, say exactly what you're thinking without having sort of a veneer or an air of consistently trying to seem smarter, right? in a room. And when you're in that mindset where you feel truly yourself and you're bringing 100% of your identity to work every day, that's when you're thinking actually the smartest, and that's when you're able to make the best decisions. And that is something that I didn't know before. And the reason I'm so, so excited about Touring Capital, I'm excited about the offering that we have and what's differentiated about it. But what I'm most excited about is my two partners and getting to do this with them, because I've worked with them for almost the better half of a better part of a decade now. And Nagaraj in particular has been a longstanding mentor for me over time. And so the ability to get to build something with him and with Samir is, it doesn't feel like work, honestly. It feels like life. This is life. This is a partnership. This is family. And it feels like something that we talked a little bit before about blending work and personal together. This is my legacy that I want to build with people that I love, respect, and trust.
I love that. I love that answer, especially investing in working with people that you love and trust, because at the end of the day, we do want to work with people who make us happy. We don't want to work with people that bring bad energy into our lives. And I think that is an important aspect of venture that we constantly continue to forget is, hey, can you foresee working with this person for the next 5, 10, 15 years? Because you hope that every founder that you meet is trying to build something that's generational.
Yes.
And, that can last and withstand the test of time. And during that journey, can you add value? Can you see yourself growing with them as much as they are growing on their own? And you really, at the end of the day, can have fun with them, because some aspect of work also has to be fun. And as much as it's a serious job, there's a lot about that human relationship that makes it a very interesting and very fulfilling journey. And that to me has been my biggest takeaway from ventures, with the wonderful people that I've met. And another reason why I continue to do this podcast is it just makes me come across people like you, people who have diverse, interesting, beautiful stories to tell. And you do not get that in a different career. I'm sorry, I could be very biased, but I feel I've met a lot of interesting people just because of the virtue of being in VC. It could be founders, it could be people working adjacent to VCs, but VCs themselves. I think it's a very interesting career path, and a lot of people getting into it come from such diverse backgrounds that it just adds so much flavor to it. Yeah. And VC is not what it used to be like 10 years ago, where it was traditional men in suits and, you know, who came from a very stereotypical path. And now you have people coming from all walks of life with interesting stories and different theses to investing in people. And you just want to study people who invest in companies as opposed to just even investing. It's just interesting to see how different backgrounds can help shape decision making and how that eventually ends up having an impact on the world, because everything is somewhat related in one way, shape, or form. So I love that. And on that note, I would love to thank you for being on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure. I don't know if you observed this, but over the course of the last 60 minutes, we didn't really talk about investing as such. We didn't really talk about any of the investments that you've made. And that's intentional, because it's good to talk about that stuff as well, but it's some of the things that we touched upon today were things that don't really meet the attention of the end listener. And that to me is something that I have taken a lot of personal pride in, is just bringing out a different side to VCs. And I've really enjoyed getting to know who you are, how you think, what are your framework for decision making, and things that have influenced you from your childhood to, you know, your middle years, and some of the insecurities that you've had while you're at your job. And those are the realities of being in this position. And you were absolutely generous in sharing those insights and those thoughts with us. So again, very grateful for having you here. And hopefully we can bring you back on the podcast in about a year's time and talk about everything that you've learned over your time investing with Touring.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Thank you so much for having me, Akash. It's so refreshing to have conversations like this versus, you know, what are the sectors that you invest in, and tell me a little bit more about the investments you've made, which is fine as well. But this is, this is
helping. You're going to be doing that on another podcast anyway.
Yeah, exactly. This has helped me get even more in touch with myself, which is lovely.